The NDP are by no means the only voice criticising the Alberta government for their industry-friendly policies. Ricardo Acuna is the Associate Director of the Parkland Institute, an Alberta-wide non-partisan research centre. Earlier this year, he published an article in Edmonton's View magazine outlining his concerns over the recent royalty review, and we quote a section here. Conservatives use the word competitiveness as a code for giving corporations what they want, and this current review is no different. Energy Minister Ron Liepert, whose department is heading up the review, has made it clear that what they're talking about is reducing royalties, reducing corporate taxes, reducing environmental regulations, and reducing health and safety regulations. It should come as no surprise, therefore, that the industry is already smiling from ear to ear about what's in the review. Unlike with the royalty review of a few years ago, the competitiveness review did not have to deal with any messy public consultations or meetings with environmental and public interest groups. Instead, the only ones who were given a say in what went into this review was the industry itself. They got to tell the government what would make them happy, and the government got to give it to them. End quote. Ricardo Acuna made the point that a royalty reduction made little sense even from a purely economic standpoint. When the environmental and social impacts were considered also, such a move seems plain nonsensical. As Albertans and Canadians saw, however, the political influence of the industry outweighed such high-minded considerations. The process of rent-seeking and lobbying is not uniquely Albertan, not by a long shot. Similar processes go on in legislatures all across this country, and indeed are probably much worse in other countries. However, we at Terra Informa feels that the Alberta case is a prime example of the need to keep lawmaking as free and fair as possible. Separate oil and state indeed. My name is David Karchin, and this opinion piece was written by Miles Curry and myself.
Thanks for listening to this week's edition of Terra Informa. You'll find all of our episodes online at terrainforma.ca. Have a great week.
The rights of tens of thousands of migrants working as living caregivers in Ontario are being neglected. As the name suggests, caregivers give care to those in need of assistance. But who's caring for the rights and needs of migrants working as living caregivers? Migrante Ontario is a non-profit organization advocating for the rights and well-being of migrants working as living caregivers. The passing of Bill C-50 has made it easier for people working in Canadian migrant worker programs to work with temporary status, but harder to gain permanent residency. Working with temporary status in Canada leaves the rights of migrant workers far less protected. However, most migrants who come to Canada are led to believe that they have the chance to become Canadian citizens. Interested in getting involved with the Guelph contingent of Migrante Ontario? Connect with us at migrante.ontario@gmail.com. That's migrante.ontario@gmail.com.
Starkraven Radio. The first three Tuesdays of each month. From 1 to 2 p.m. We take a closer look at the politics of prisons and criminalization on your community radio station, CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
Action Read Community Literacy Center offers one-on-one tutoring and small group learning in reading, writing, math, and computers for adults aged 18 and over in Guelph. At Action Read, we help you identify what you're good at so you can work towards your goals. Learn skills to get the job you want, to work on personal budgets, creative writing projects, for test preparation, and to improve study skills. Our services are free and no referral is needed. If Action Read sounds like the place for you or someone you know, contact us at 519-836-2759 or visit us on the web at actionread.com.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Kurdish.
Amongst them is Dmitry Muzichenko, who's from the advertising industry. Dmitry, just tell me, just how difficult are you finding living in a city at the moment?
I'm living in a regular Soviet flat, which is basically a house built of concrete, which means there is no air conditioning. So it's actually a bit warmer than it is outside. It doesn't get cooler at night. It's quite hard to sleep. Usually I wake up every hour, like 3 a.m., 4 a.m., 5 a.m., 6 a.m., drinking water, getting back to sleep. With the smoke, it's a bit more often, I would say. Yeah, but at the end of the day, you wake up and you go to work. What else can you do?
And how damaging do you feel it is? Do you feel this is damaging your health?
Yeah. The eyes, you feel like crying. Yeah, you feel coughing. Yeah, you feel coughing. And it's really hard to breathe because of the amount of oxygen is reduced versus normal in the air. So these things you feel. Fortunately, I'm a healthy person, so I don't really kind of go sick. But from what I know, the people who really don't have that much health, they feel really, really bad these days. And some of them just go out of the city for a week or two just to kind of recover themselves.
Well, Dimitri, thanks and good luck. And obviously what everyone's waiting for is for the weather to change and for the fires to be put out. There have been many, many promises given by the authorities. The latest they're saying is the weather will cool down eventually, perhaps by the end of this week. And certainly one of the major ministries involved in fighting the fires are saying they think they can get them out, the fires around Moscow, that is, within the next 5 to 7 days. But I think, to be honest, there'll be very few people who are going to take that at face value. They'll only actually believe it when it happens.
That's the BBC's Richard Galpin in Moscow. Well, some businesses in the Russian capital have been telling their employees to take extra holiday or leave the city altogether because of the smog. Tim Jenkins is our business reporter. Tim, who's getting extra time off?
Well, clearly a lot of people don't have any choice, do they, Paul? Their holidays are over and they just can't pick and choose where or when to work. But if you can, if you work for a big company, for example, there's maybe a bit of room for flexibility. So some bosses are saying to their staff, don't come in if you don't have to. Take the foreign firm British American Tobacco. Now then, they might be in the business of making smoke normally, but they've told staff to choose where and when to work where it's possible. William Maudlin's with the Wall Street Journal in Moscow. He's been ringing around his business contacts, like people at BAT, and he's finding a lot of them not there. And he himself had a choking journey into work this morning. He works just a couple of streets away from Red Square.
Well, I came to work in the centre of Moscow, and the smoke was so bad it was making some people dizzy and faint. And as soon as I got here, I heard a whistling sound in the window. Perhaps because of the pressure, smoke started seeping in. We had to get the maintenance to fix the building, and for a second it was a reminder of just how horrible it is outside on the street.
And almost impossible to work in. So what are your friends, what are your contacts saying to you about measures they're taking now to continue their business?
Some people are working from home. The smoke was too much for British American Tobacco, and they actually allowed employees to work different hours. Some are headed to St. Petersburg, and many people have gone abroad.
Have actually gone abroad? Is that like an evacuation or just, oh, okay, guys, take what steps you want, maybe take a little extra holiday?
Pretty much the latter. There's still millions of people here in Moscow, but many people would rather be outside the city. The problem is most Muscovites have dachas, or little country houses where they can escape normally from the heat, but many of the dachas are threatened by forest fires as well and smoke coming from the fires. So it's not much better out there. You have to go quite a long way to escape the smoke and heat.
I wonder if employers could find themselves legally liable if they require their staff to come into work when on their journey to work or at work they're exposed to this dreadful smog.
It's interesting. I don't think employers know the answer. Maybe their legal departments do. So they're sort of being very mild. Investment banks and other places, many employees are, you know, encouraged to make their own decisions, and the employers are being very flexible with them, perhaps because of that.
Any idea as to how much this is going to cost the Moscow economy, the Russian economy?
We don't know exactly, but there will be an effect. The fact that it happened in the summer period when business is not quite as active as a normal part of the year means that it might have less effect. But I think it'll take some time before we figure out what exactly the impact is. After all, investment bank economists aren't necessarily at work today to crunch these numbers themselves.
No, they're not. They're one of the lucky ones that can pick and choose where to be. And as you point out, Paul, not an awful lot of people in Moscow actually have those dachas to escape to. That was William Maldin of the Wall Street Journal pointing out, mind you, that work is the place to be for some people. Now, why would that be the case? Well, All to do with air conditioning, of course. There are some people going to work and working longer hours just because the office has got air conditioning. So you're actually finding people working 10, 11, 12 hours at work just to stay away from that dirty atmosphere outside that's leaking into their flats.
Of course. Thank you, Tim. In Portugal, more than 400 firefighters have been trying to control a blaze that's been more or less out of control for 4 days in São Pedro do Sul in the south. Many other wildfires are burning, not unusual in high summer in tinder-dry conditions in Portugal, but combined with the damage of last summer, the environmental cost will be high. The BBC's Alison Roberts is in Lisbon and she joins me. Alison, we've just heard from Moscow about residents struggling to cope with the heat and the smog. What's it like there?
Well, there's been a crescendo of fires here in Portugal since the start of August, really. Sunday was the worst day, with a staggering 500 or so fires. Some of them were quite small, but the biggest one, as you mentioned, near São Pedro do Sul, was huge, burning on several fronts and taking, as you mentioned, something like 450 firefighters to bring it under control. Portugal's only national park has also been under threat. Today, civil defence forces have reported 280 or so fires. Just 46 are still burning this afternoon, though. One big difference with the situation in Russia is that the fires we're seeing in Portugal this year, as in the past, tend to be well away from large towns and cities. That's because the population here is very much concentrated along the Atlantic coastal strip, while the forests are inland. But of course, for the significant number of people that are directly affected by fires, the situation is nightmarish. And so it's hard for them to forgive any operational hiccups. Over the weekend, the deputy mayor of São Pedro do Sul, Adriana Azevedo, for one, had some pretty harsh words for emergency service commanders.
What I think is that the local coordination should be closer to the ground. We should have commanders who understand how the fire is developing down here. It's no good being kilometres away overseeing a fire with people sent in from various localities who don't even know the roads or forest tracks and to a certain extent are lost.
Alison, how justified do you think complaints like that are?
Well, the fact is that with the affected areas so dispersed, it's inevitable that resources will be called in from further afield. And that does mean that a very high degree of coordination is needed. And it is not always achieved when there are so many fires on at the same time. In terms of overall resources, though, Portugal is definitely better equipped than it was, say, a decade ago in terms of aircraft as well as vehicles and men and women.
How is the government reassuring people?
Well, in comments to journalists during a visit to one of the fire fronts over the weekend, Home Affairs Minister Rui Pereira expressed confidence in the capabilities of the emergency services, but he also stressed that the public has a role to play.
It's a very difficult situation, facing more than 400 fires a day, and that's what's happened over the past week. But the truth is that we're extinguishing most of the fires during the day. The ones that keep going into the end of the day and into the night are a minority. But then at night, new fires start. That means that people aren't taking care. And here, I appeal again to all Portuguese. Our motto is Portugal without fires depends on everyone. And I'm appealing for everyone to be more careful.
And are people likely to heed the minister's warning to be more careful?
Well, for one thing, there does seem to be a persistent and widespread belief here in Portugal that arson is the cause of the overwhelming majority of forest fires. It's really conspiracy theories are rife every summer when we have these forest fires, as we do every summer. But while police do often follow these allegations up, the fact is that only a handful of people have ever been charged. And forestry experts say that carelessness on the part of the public is a very big issue, and it remains one. But the fact is also that the carelessness is made worse by the fact that forests are often not properly maintained by their owners, not least because they're often tiny parcels of property in remote areas and rarely visited by their owners themselves.
Alison Roberts in Lisbon in Portugal. Thank you very much. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Europe Today. Now, across Europe, governments are announcing painful budget cuts in order to pay off public debt. In many countries, unemployment is rising and the euro, designed to protect its users against damaging currency fluctuations, is at a record low on the international markets. But there is at least one European country that seems immune from these hardships. Imogen Fuchs reports from Bern.
Swiss National Day. Every August, Switzerland celebrates its existence with a nationwide firework display. And this year, while much of the rest of Europe buckles down to austerity measures, the Swiss are feeling especially good about themselves.
We have high salaries and high wages. We have an interest rate here in Switzerland, also on mortgages, that's very, very low compared to European standard. Switzerland has a VAT rate of 7.6%. The European Union has a minimum level of VAT of 15%.
Stefan Meyerhans, head of Switzerland's price monitoring office, counts the ways it's so good to be Swiss. Staying out of the European Union, hanging on to a strong Swiss franc, and saying no to the euro are paying off.
The cost of living, the index, and this is an index that's calculated on a very big bag of different products, has come down last year by 0.5%. So that means life has gotten cheaper in Switzerland.
It's the middle of the morning in the middle of the week in Switzerland's capital, and yet the shops and the cafes are bustling. They are price reductions, euro bonuses, the shops are calling them, offered on all sorts of goods, from cars to electronics to groceries, even holidays.
We have melons, we have apricots, we have peaches and nectarines. We buy them in Italy and in Spain. And of course, there we've seen the very important decrease of the euro against the Swiss franc. So there we give the advantage we have to the customer.
It's the same story over at the Kuoni travel agent, where Iris Jaeger has euro bargains galore.
For instance, I'll show you here, we have for the summer season Sardinia, where you can save up about 750 francs per person for 1 week, so which is just an amazing rebate, because it's a 4-star hotel directly on the beach, very nice area in the North Sardinia, Golfo di Marinella, beautiful.
You've got some very happy customers then this year.
I only have happy customers, actually.
Happy customers indeed, with those strong Swiss francs jingling in their pockets.
The euro is low, and we were on holidays in France and in Germany, and I'm very happy. I appreciate it.
Yes, I'm happy. I think it's a good currency. For a long time, I thought that's the wrong decision, but now when I look at all the problems with Greece and also with other countries, I'm not sure if it is not better to rest out of European Union.
I would like to keep the franc. I wouldn't like to go into the United Union, or whatever it's called.
When Switzerland first voted against joining the European Union, the decision split the country. Just 50.3% in favour of staying away from Brussels, 49.7% in favour of getting closer. Today, when I meet political scientist Dieter Freiburghaus in one of those busy cafes, he tells me opinions against Brussels are hardening.
Only 30% of Swiss people would be ready to adhere to the European Union. It was much higher years before. It went up to 50%. Now it's very, very low. And I mean, it's quite understandable. There is a cultural gap between Brussels and Switzerland. Swiss like things to be small. Brussels like things to be big. Swiss people don't feel alone. Or I might say they feel better when they feel alone. That's a very long tradition. And to change that, we should be with them, we should join, we should have friends everywhere. It's not our attitude.
In fact, even as a non-member of the European Union, Switzerland has adopted a large number of EU policies, those it finds advantageous. More harmonisation is inevitable, but for now, their current unexpected prosperity is making the Swiss decision to go it alone and keep at least some economic independence look less like aloofness and more like common sense.
Imogen Fuchs reporting there from Switzerland. Now, at least 11 people are known to have died now in floods in Central Europe, which were at their height over the weekend. The worst affected region has been around the borders of Poland, Germany and the Czech Republic. In eastern Germany, several roads and villages there were flooded by the river Neisser, and the police ordered residents of Görlitz to leave the worst hit areas.
Zum wiederholten Male, verlassen Sie das Neisseufer.
This is a repeated warning, she says. Leave the riverbanks now. Hundreds of people had to be rescued from their homes by rescue workers in rubber dinghies. And the mayor, Joachim Paulik, described the situation as a disaster.
It's a catastrophe. When I look at this, I've never seen this much water before. We have to clear the bridge. We can't secure it. We hope it holds.
In one Polish town, Bogatynia, a bridge was destroyed and some inhabitants were lucky to escape with their lives.
The water started to rise very quickly. The electricity was on, so if my son hadn't been there, it would have killed me. We escaped through the window. There was no chance to rescue anything.
Well, there is such a thing as a Europe-wide flood alert system, and it's working on more accurate early warning systems to try to avoid the worst disasters. I've been speaking to Ap de Roe, who's coordinator of the centre based near Milan in northern Italy, and asked him first if the number and severity of floods in Europe was increasing.
In Central Europe, it's not the first time that that floods occur in summer. We had the big Oder flood in 1997, then the Elbe flooding in 2002, another big flooding in August 2005 in southern Germany. So it's not the first time, but it is a bit of a bad year indeed for the region.
And indeed, is there a pattern of things getting worse, do you think?
We don't have any evidence for it. We also haven't fully investigated that, but I think it's too early to tell.
But what is crucial is being able to forecast these things so that governments and emergency services can do what they can. What stage are we at with your systems?
Well, I think we're getting better and better. As the countries do have their own forecasting system, and they typically forecast for the next 2 days what could happen on their territory. And we have a European early warning system, and we're in close contact with all the national services. And what we do is we look further ahead, let's say a week, up to 15 days at the moment, where we try to make a forecast what might happen in the coming days, and then we send that to the national services.
And were there accurate forecasts for these floods? Did the Czech government, for example, know 2 days in advance that something like this was likely to happen?
We did send to the Czechs, we did send on Friday a watch situation that something could happen. This was a difficult one. There was no, well, as in a forecast, there is never 100% guarantee, but it was still quite uncertain, so we were a bit cautious. The thing is, and that happened last year also in the Czech Republic, with these kind of things during summer, you never know exactly where they're going to hit. It was quite likely that they would hit somewhere in the Czech Republic or in that region, but you never know exactly where. That's the problem.
You're working on 10-day forecasts. That sounds very ambitious.
Well, it's up to 10 days. So we also make a 3-day forecast and a 4-day forecast. And typically a 3-day or a 4-day forecast is a bit more reliable than a 10-day forecast. But you start to pick up a signal. You know, for some floods, we have already made a successful forecast 6-7 days before. Sometimes you get a first signal that something might happen in 9 days, and then it's confirmed 8 days before and 7 days before, and then we are convinced enough to contact the countries and say, hey, this is a stable forecast. Watch out, something might happen in your country. And in that respect, we're quite good. We don't make too many, let's say, false alarms on that.
Accurate data must be crucial, but so, I would imagine, is trust. And how much credibility is someone in Lithuania going to give a call from northern Italy to say your immediate locality could go underwater soon?
Yeah, well, that's a process that lasts for a couple of years. We're basically pre-operational since 2003, and then the trust you have to build with the countries that they, that you don't make too many false alarms, that you try to make a good quality system, and that's, I think, that the trust is growing over the years.
That's Ap de Roe, who's coordinator of Europe's Flood Warning Centre in Italy. Are you in the flood area? Tell us your story. We'd like to hear it on this email address, worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com. Some sports news now, and Tiger Woods will go into the US PGA Championship on Thursday in the worst form of his life, and with automatic qualification for the Ryder Cup, a distant prospect. The world number one finished second to last in the field at the event in Ohio yesterday. Addy Adedoyin is from our sports desk and he joins me. Addy, how badly did he play in Ohio then?
Well, Paul, he not only finished second to last in Ohio, but he was 30 shots behind the winner, Hunter Mahan. He remains the world number one only because Phil Mickelson managed to play even worse in the final round and effectively blew the opportunity to replace him at the top of the world rankings. Now, Woods was asked at a news conference afterwards if he feels he should be selected for the US Ryder Cup team based on his current form.
Not playing like this, I wouldn't help the team if I'm playing like this. No one would help the team if they're shooting 18 over par. I think I can turn it around, but we got a lot of time before now and then.
Been able to stay in like a positive frame of mind at all through any of this? Does it get increasingly more difficult given everything?
Well, that's tough. Only thing I can say all week is I was patient, and unfortunately that's not enough.
Clearly a man with problems on and off the course at the moment, Paul.
What are the criteria for selection for the team?
Well, Woods currently lies 10th in the US Ryder Cup list and will miss out on automatic selection unless he performs well at this week's US PGA Championship. Now, if he fails to rise into the top eight, he'll then have to rely on a wild card. And Steve Elling, a golf reporter for CBS Television in the United States, says that's unlikely to happen unless he sorts out the problems in his personal life.
I'm sure you can't separate the two. Everybody keeps saying, well, is this because of what's going on at home? Well, nobody really knows what's going on there. You know, the tales there are being, kind of coming out in fits and spurts with an eyedropper. Lots of assumptions being made about, you know, the divorce being imminent, but there's no paperwork on that. So I'm guessing that sword is still kind of dangling over his head. And, it's embarrassing. He's being, this has been a huge public humiliation for him. And now it's a professional humiliation as well as a personal one.
And away from golf, Paul, just one line of football for you. Martin O'Neill has resigned as manager of the English Premier League side Aston Villa with immediate effect. No reason has been given as yet, but O'Neill has said in a statement, it's obviously a wrench to believe in such a magnificent club. Villa, in turn, have thanked him for his great work he's done during the last 4 years. He leaves just 5 days before the start of the new season.
Thank you, Addy. That's Addy Adedoyin from the BBC Sports Desk. Now, a reminder of our top story on Europe today. Islamic groups in Germany have been criticising a raid on a mosque in Hamburg, which was linked to the September 11th attacks of 2001. Police say the Taiba Mosque was being used as a meeting point for extremists. The ringleader of the September the 11th attacks, Mohammed Atta, frequented the mosque before he moved to the US, as did two other key figures in those attacks. We've been speaking to the Hamburg journalist Joachim Hagen.
This mosque was one of the main attraction points where young fundamentalists go. And 1 year ago, there was a group of 11 young fundamentalists who was trying to go to Afghanistan, and they did that. And the intelligence found out that one of them, at least, was made his way to one of the training camps of the Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan-Pakistan border.
That's Joachim Hagen in Hamburg today. You can get more on that story on the website bbcnews.com and in bulletins throughout the day. And remember, you can always get in touch with this programme, the email address worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com, or you can post on our Facebook site, BBC Europe Today. Thanks for listening to the programme. Stay tuned with the BBC World Service.
To the BBC World Service and are trying to work out what's on when, we've got a neat little way to help you. Go to bbcworldservice.com and click How and When to listen.
BBC in Naples.
Tel Aviv.
Perth.
Accra.
Wherever you are, you're with the BBC.